Dr. Bob Fitrakis bringing you the other side of the news on WGRN 94.1.
Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
I'm here with my special guest and good friend, Dr. Marilyn Howard, from Columbus State, where she teaches African American studies, Black studies, and even is sympathetic to that white historical progressive movement as well. Dr. Howard, welcome to the other side of the news.
How are you? Well, you see all the books behind me, so I'm keeping up on my reading while we're off, and thank God the semester's over.
And because it's academic and important, let's talk about the death of Little Richard.
It is, and I want to thank you for pointing out there. Somewhere, someone must have done a thesis or a dissertation on him. There's got to be one out there. He made rock and roll. Forget about Bill Haley and the Commons, although you got to think about Ike Turner's Rocket. Was it Rocket 66?
Oh, 88.
Rocket 88.
The Delta 88, yeah.
Little Richard is rock and roll. And he was even older than I thought he was. He was 87. So I thought he was like in his late 70s. But he put a whole bunch of them in the ground. Bo Diddley, Ike Turner. But
many
I was really sad about that.
He was the predecessor of the gender bender.
He was.
Of the
think about Prince.
David Bowie. Yeah. And Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger, Prince.
DC.
Prince is a walking copy of Little Richard.
But really, in some ways, I would argue that what he brought in was Black Pentecostal music in the mainstream culture.
Yeah. He did.
Pentecostal, great halls of fire.
Yeah.
But the man who merged in Black Pentecostal and that whole style of, boogie-woogie, fast-paced piano playing that you were only hearing inside the Black Pentecostal churches.
Exactly.
He was testifying to the whole nation.
He was. He was, and as you say, he was out front in gender bending, although he did say he'd try anything once.
But, he was trisexual, as we know.
Trisexual, or what do they call it now? Trisexual, or
we might call it gender fluid.
But he was, as you say, that left hand was boogie woogie, and that right hand was all over the place. And it sounds like Gospel Tabernacle, which is a church my Aunt Laurabelle used to go to when I was young, and I would go there with my mother sometimes. So that is straight out of the Black church, the Black Pentecostal church. Which took much to the consternation of Black Pentecostals. But he was, it was the makeup and the hair and the band was all made up and everything. And he had this, full band. And if you were a white teenager in the 50s and you wanted to push your parents' budget, then you bought Little Richard records. And concerts always full and everything. So he's the first mainstream person. And when you think of mainstream, I think sometimes you think about Motown, for instance. That was Berry Gordy's goal, that Motown would be the sound of young America, not just young Black America, but young America.
Young white America.
Yeah, exactly.
And they weren't out there gender-bended.
No, they were not.
They weren't pushing the edge. That's Little Richard.
They had, pushing the edge for them was the Supremes singing a song about love child and a woman not wanting to have sex with her teenage boyfriend. But he was out there. He was out there before anybody. People have he always said he was the originator. He was the facilitator. He was the one and only Little Richard. So I think it's a sad day for music, for culture, for the Black community. I'm going to do for him what I did for James Brown. I think I'm going to do a 30 day mourning period, just wear black and listen to Little Richard.
I think so.
Yeah.
Well, they also, for the record, they changed the words to Tutti Frutti.
They did indeed. They did indeed.
And they changed it to Aunt Rudy.
You know what,
might have different meaning, but the original lyrics were Tutti Frutti,
Tutti Frutti
good booty.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't ease it, just squeeze it.
Yeah. So He said he always he hated what Pat Boone did to us, so he always tried to sing it extra fast so nobody would get him mixed up with Pat Boone. There was no chance of that. But yeah,
Pat Boone sort of stripped the soul and heart out of a rock and roll.
Yeah.
All those, you know, kind of false white idols like Bobby Darin and Bobby Rydell.
Yeah.
They were trying to really cover what originally were black songs. As you well know, in the 50s, Elvis was the product of
what
we called race music.
Race music. Right,
which was the black charts.
Yeah.
And what they literally called, they didn't call it country and western, hillbilly music.
Hillbilly, rockabilly or hillbilly.
Yes, Elvis was the hybrid of a hillbilly with a little race music soul. He stole a lot of those songs. Junior Parker already had a number one hit on the race charts with Mystery Train.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, a friend of yours, Big Mama Thornton.
Big Mama Thornton.
That's already right. Had
Hound Dog.
A hit with You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog.
Hound Dog.
And you when know, she I sang almost... it, it was about a man dogging her out. It wasn't, when Elvis sang it, it was about a hound dog.
Hound dog. You know, I have a Coco Taylor CD. Yeah. She died 2 days, I think, before Michael Jackson. So she really got eclipsed in all of that Michael Jackson folderol. But she has a recording Hound Dog on there. She dedicated it to Big Mama Thornton and Elvis Presley. But you know, Elvis, he lived really close to a black church and he used to sit out on the porch and listen to choir practice. I remember that from when I was a kid. We'd throw the doors open, people come by, come sit in the church and hear us practice. So
Presley did a few traditional gospel albums.
He did indeed. And in fact,
did a very good version of Peace in the Valley.
Yeah. He was on, I think
that
was for gospel music. So Richard was, Little Richard was really out there. And he really literally was the last one. I think they're all gone now, except for Jerry Lee Lewis. Jerry Lee Lewis, he's like a cat with nine lives.
Yeah, well.
And did you hear that Betty Wright died?
Was that early marriage to his 13-year-old first cousin? Hey, it was legal, Miss Dr. Howard.
Yes, it was.
He had her parents' permission.
That's right.
He kidnapped her and took her from Louisiana to Mississippi, where it was legal for him to marry her.
Well, listen, my grandparents on my father's side, my dad grew up in Vinton County. They lived in West Virginia. When he was five, they moved to Vinton County. That's Appalachia, Ohio. And my grandmother was 14 and my grandfather was 27 when they got married. So that was common in that area of the state.
Well, it was also common apparently in Greece, where my yaya was 13 when she married her first husband.
Oh my goodness.
50.
Ooh.
She complained, Marilyn, that he smelled like goat. But he was a goat herder. So yeah. I'm thinking.
Hey, and speaking of goat herders, did you see a couple days ago where some goats got out of a pasture and about 200 of them went into the middle of the city? Because, you know, nobody's out, so the goats are out. Getting all these crazy animal stories.
But so when the humans are away, we'll pardon it.
And the rats in New York City are really mad, too, because the restaurants are all closed.
Yeah, they have reports they've been fighting with each other.
Yes, they are. Now, you know, we lost another titan of black music this week, and that was Betty Wright. Do you remember the Clean Up Woman?
Yeah.
I can still hear that little guitar riff there. That was Betty Wright of the Clean Up Woman fame, and she wrote and produced. In fact, I just learned the other day, you know, reading the story about her, that she was the one who wrote Where's the Love that turned out to be such a big hit for Donny Hathaway and Roberta Flack.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So she wrote, she produced, she represented people. So she's gone. She was young. She was 66. So we lost two really big ones. The patriarch of Wynton Marsalis and all them, their dad died several weeks ago. So it's been tough. Been kind of tough.
I know. As part of being locked down, I was watching the Motown documentary.
Oh, okay.
On Netflix, it was great.
Yeah, it's sad though. You know, they when you think there's only one of the original Temptations left, there's only one of the original Four Tops left.
Well, there was a whole documentary about the Sidemen, who were considered, I mean, totally unknown, didn't make much money, but were considered some of the, played on more hits than anybody.
They were like, and, you know, they
go from gig to gig sidemen that played for Motown.
Yeah, they did a documentary on them several years ago, so at least, you know, people are starting to get their due. But, you know, Motown was such a, you know, it was a lot of that Phil Spector in there, the Wall of Sound. You could hear the violins and a lot of the Motown Love records and things like that. That was all out there in the 60s. And because I had two older siblings, you know, one who was 8 years older, one who was 5 years older, I heard all that stuff. I grew up hearing all that.
And who did Entertainment Weekly call the Berry Gordy of Columbus?
Streaming to you from the Indie Media Studios of the Free Press Network here on YouTube, but also available online at WGRN.org. Plus, listen to us on Columbus, Ohio's two volunteer-run low-power FM radio stations, Fridays at 5:30 p.m. on WGRN 94.1 The Green Renaissance, and Mondays, 5:30 p.m. on WCRS 92.7 and 98.3.
Bill Moss?
Bill Moss! The really? Boss with the Red Hot Sauce.
Well,
volume one of Rare Soul.
Yes.
The first volume put out was based on Capsole Records right here in Columbus. And I'm sure you may have had an innocent makeout party to the Four Mints.
I plead.
Row your boat gently up my stream.
I plead the fifth.
Hey, are you familiar with the Four Mints?
Yeah, you know.
Under oath.
My friend PD, he has all Bill Moss's records. He's got every last one of them. So yeah, he was the Berry Gordy of Columbus, Ohio. He sure was. Sad week for music, though. Sad week.
It is. And again, we don't really think about it, but really, I mean, the unique forms of American music, rock and roll, which came out of Black culture, and of course, jazz, which came out of, you know, Delta, essentially funeral dirges, which was also Black music.
Yeah. And in fact, a lot of ethnography people and musicologists and stuff, they posit that jazz is the only indigenous American art form, that everything else was borrowed from Europe. Hmm. Everything else was borrowed. So that's, and what's odd about that is that jazz and blues, and I'm talking about real jazz. I'm not talking about Kenny G. I mean, I like Kenny G. There's a place for people like him.
Tough jazz.
Still jazz.
White boy jazz.
Yeah. And, you know, that is not, jazz and blues are not two genres that are popular in the African-American community. Before we went to semesters and we had a little bit more class time, I would always do a thing on the blues. And I'd say, we're going to talk about the blues today. And it'll be, oh, but as you know, I collect blues lyrics. So I'd have like a 6-page handout of lyrics and stuff. And once they could hear the lyrics and listen to the stuff, that, you know, they like it.
But, and once, what about a big leg woman?
Yeah, that's right. Big leg. I was singing that in my head. That was something I used to tease my late fiance about. We were sitting in the funeral home and it popped into my head because he talks about he don't need no flowers on his grave. When he die, all he crave is big leg women people to take him to the grave. He didn't need that. And I thought about that and I kind of
Zuzu both.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, one of the things I point out to my students is that, there's bawdy blues, you know, like Shave 'em Dry and My Stove's in Good Condition and stuff like that. But blues has nuance and innuendo in it, you know, whereas rap, you think of the Whisper Song or something, you know, it's all just all out there. Blues is a very significant category, and it's not just, you know, 12 bars. It's really intricate. So,
but sometimes it's crossover and you want to ride your horse to the Old Town Road.
Yes.
That caused controversy. Yeah. I mean, they wouldn't declare it as country music because it was the most popular song that year.
You're something else, you know that. Moving on.
Give the man his award.
Yeah.
All right. So what you been reading lately?
Well, I just finished two books. One is called Barack and Joe. So it's about their bromance and how they start on total opposite ends of the spectrum. In fact, there's an anecdote in there about Obama, and he was sitting in a Senate hearing, and Joe was talking, and Obama wrote a note and held it up in front of his staff member, and it said, "Shoot me, please," because, you know, he can talk. He can talk, but that's got to be...
He has a tendency to meander.
Yeah, but that's got to be one of the strangest relationships.
Well, the Black community, which saved him, I mean, the Black community, which could have delivered democratic socialism and equality,
yes,
went with corporate capitalism,
yeah,
and literally saved Joe Biden.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, there's a lot of pressure for him to pick a Black woman as a running mate. So I don't think he will. I think he will pick a woman, but I do not think it's going to be a Black woman. Now, a friend of mine says he thinks what's going to happen is that the president and the vice president will get COVID-19. They'll both pass away, and then we'll have our Speaker of the House, who will be the president, since she's next in line, Nancy Pelosi. So, but yeah, Biden, it is a perfect example of how the Black community, particularly Black female voters, save the jobs and electoral chances of many a white politician. And
was it because he was special, bless his heart kind of way?
Well,
what they used to say, touched. I mean, he occasionally looks cognitively impaired.
Yeah, he.
It's clearly because he's Obama, was Obama's running.
Yes, he, yes. But when he was in that race, when he was in that race, a lot of people were digging up his record from the 70s where he was against busing for racial balance.
And like to hang out with some of them old bits of cats.
Yeah, so, I don't think he's going to pick a Black woman. I just don't see that happen. If it does, I'll be even more surprised than I was when Obama won the presidency. I never thought I'd live to see that day. So, we'll see what he does.
So you think, pretty much they've often the Democrats have taken the Black vote for granted.
Very much for granted.
Going to go.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it is what Frederick Douglass once said, I think, about the Republican Party. The Republican Party is the deck, all else is the sea. And I think that's where the Democrats are now in the Black community. So I just finished reading that, and it really is remarkable to read not only how they came to respect each other and help each other. I mean, Obama did the eulogy for Biden's son. The granddaughters and the Obama daughters are very close kids right from the start, but that they genuinely liked each other. You know, Obama wasn't the first person to give the vice president something tangible to do. I think that was probably Jimmy Carter. But, you know, the Bidens, they travel together. They, you know, so there's some genuine affection there. There's a little weird part in the last chapter where there's a lot of talk about love and poetry and stuff like that, and I'm not sure that I'd go that far. But it is remarkable when you look at the pictures of them. And let me hold this up. I don't know if you can see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Raise it up a little more, a little higher. Right there, Barack and Joe.
Yeah.
And they look like they're having a good time.
They are. So it was very interesting to read about that. So I'm done with that, and I'm working on the review. And I also, the other one I'm working on is a book called Grace Will Lead Us Home. And the subtitle is The Charlton Church Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. That was 5 years ago. I'm thinking it was two. It was five, already 5 years since that young white boy walked into a Black church. Well, they pulled a chair out for him, found a Bible for him because he didn't have a Bible. And he sat there. In fact, he said they were so nice to him. They were so welcoming that at the last minute, he almost decided he could not kill them.
Yeah.
And I know. Yeah, like, oh, they're too nice to me. I can't kill them. But this, what I, this book is interesting in that, you know, we're 5 years out from this, and she pays a lot of attention to the families of these people, how it, the death affected the individual family members, the community. And also something that's been in the public conversation on the Black blogosphere for several years, or every time one of these things happen, and that is, are Black people too quick to forgive white people?
You know, female police officer.
Yes, yes, and that's exactly.
She wasn't even out of the courtroom.
Yes. And the same thing with this Dylan Roof, I think it was, who shot these people in church. The same thing. Some of some of their family members showed up and offered him forgiveness, or, you know, right there when he was arraigned. And it's like, it's almost as though it makes it safe for white people to, at least in the beginning, express some sorrow and things like that, leave teddy bears and flowers at the scene and stuff like that, because they can say, well, you know, we hate this form of racism, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, in a week, 2 weeks, a month, maybe, they'll turn around and go back home, where they all fall back into their de facto segregated lives. But it lets them off the hook. Oh, you know, Black people, they're going to forgive us. I can almost see them beforehand. Well, let me see here. How many Black people do you think are going to forgive us?
Well, they ain't been to Detroit.
Good question.
And then if there's a few cities where you don't get that.
Then Black people are racist. You only, you won't forgive them because it's a white person. It's Black people who are really racist and things like that. So I think that's a legitimate question in the Black community, in the larger community, in the Black church. I mean, this was Mother Emmanuel.
Meaning of Mother Emmanuel for our listeners?
Well, this is the mother church, the AME church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, African for Black, Methodist for John Wesley's doctrine, and Episcopal because the church is somewhat hierarchical. And to go to Mother Emmanuel and do something like this, I'm going to tell you something.
The AME church, right? Central in many ways. We know about the Black Baptist, Southern Baptist, but AME doesn't get quite the credit.
No, it doesn't. Yes, you're right. But those were
much more progressive than, I would argue, radical.
Yes, I mean, and those are
churches that let me in the pulpit.
Yeah,
well, you know, no white churches.
That, yes,
and maybe that some Unitarians, but the only black church that's always welcomed me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's Mother Emmanuel. That was sacred ground, and for him to and what one of the really interesting stories that comes out in this book, Grace Will Lead Us Home, is that there is a white, either Episcopal or Presbyterian church right in the back on the next street of Mother Emmanuel. And there's been a white pastor there who for years has tried to get some, you know, integrated services and get the two churches involved in working together. And one of the things that does happen is at least one of the members goes over to that church, and she decides to leave Mother Emmanuel. Now, you know, there are things going on here. There was an argument over money. Money was coming in all over the world, and no one was, or at least one person was keeping account of it, but the members didn't know how much it was or who was controlling it. You have the ego of the two subsequent pastors who worked there after the murder of the other pastor. And so there are a lot of layers to this. It's not just this cold-blooded, god-awful murder, but it's like you're peeling back layers, and it's almost like it's unfolding like a mystery, and you get to see a full story of what happens to a community when something like this happens. I mean, and his parents, I don't want to give any more of it away, but it's a great book, and so I'm going to be working on that too. So, hey, I can hold that up. Tell me when you can see it best.
Go ahead. Yeah, Grace Will Lead Us Home.
And as you know, That's from the song Amazing Grace, which has such beautiful lyrics, but the worst tune I think I've ever heard for a church song. But, you know, Obama. But
wasn't it written by a slaver?
It's he had converted. He found God. You know, my late father.
Lost, my late father used to, was blind, used to say, now I see.
Yeah, my late father used to say he it tickled me when people said they you know, I found God. He said, like, God moved and didn't leave no forwarding address.
You know, I think when God, you know, early on when you were chaining people down in the hole of the ship.
But, you know, Obama is, you know, he was up there and he started singing and they joined in. And that's a song. I grew up in the Methodist church, sang in the choir, went to Sunday school for 3 or 4 summers in a row. My brother and I went away for a week to church camp that was run by the Methodist church. So, you know, I grew up in the church and I get that it's a wonderful song, but that tune is just, oh, it's god awful. But, you know, it says so, the title, the first verse especially says so much with just a few words. And so I think that's a lovely title for this book. And I think readers will, when people see the review, they'll want
to
read it.
Well, I'm going to have to get you to write the intro to forward to the White Supremacy book.
I would. How's that coming along?
It's close. The reviewers said, yes, we're making some. But they wanted somebody who was a scholar to write the foreword of the intro.
Well, that would be me.
You. So think about that. I want to put you out.
I will. And you know what? Since it's you, I'll do it for free.
So that's, yeah, we're looking. Publisher there at OSU Press. And,
oh, all right.
He thought it was a great idea. He said you've done reviews for them.
I did. That was a couple years ago. So, I did do a review for them. And if someone had put together a book about lynching and violence in Ohio, and they asked me to take a look at it, because as you know, that is an area for me. One of the things I've discovered is that I can look at these awful things, you know, the worst lynchings, the descriptions of them in these photographs, but I cannot look at things that, you know, have happened in the present day. I just, I can't bear to read that. I guess that's the whole thing about a historian looking at the past all the time, but today is just to think. I was talking to a friend of mine today and he talked about it's almost a cliche how far Black people have come since they were dragged over here like that. But still so far, how far we have to go. But it doesn't look like to me that white people have moved very much at all.
No, and as we finish here in this pandemic, right, you yeah. see article after article, the Black population. And really the book starts, scholar I'm co-writing with, starts with essentially how the Native Americans were treated by the ideology of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. So here we are again, another pandemic, and disproportionately Native Americans on tribal lands are being hurt the worst.
Exactly.
So any last thoughts to our listeners?
Well, I'd like to add to what you said and think about these people in the first line. I think about my mother who worked in a nursing home. They are typically Black women or Black women refugees, Black African women or something. They're the ones to bathe the patients and wipe their noses and you know, all those other things. And they are really sort of getting ignored in that. You know, people are looking at the nurses and stuff, but think about those people who sure. do all those things so that nurses can do what they do. And those are primarily mostly Black women.
And Jesse Jackson, when he ran for president, raised that issue. And there's big issue question now. When they call somebody essential, in some cases, they ignore others and really are disposable.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, it's been something. It's been a heck of a week.
All right, well, thanks for being on the other side of the news, Dr. Marilyn Howard. And I hope you do write that forward.
I would be the honor of my life.
Tennessee in Ohio. Thank
Definitely.
You.
Definitely, thanks. Thanks for having me.
And hatred to mankind, poisoning their
brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.